underwear feels kind of sexy. Don't make me queer, right? Right.
All right, good evening, folks. Thank you for coming back to the podcast to be named later. Tonight, we have Jason Collette driving the ship, and Steve Slawinski and Bradley Woodrum are here with us tonight. Good morning, good morning. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello. Hey.
Great to be here, Jason.
Hey, thanks for coming on again. Well, I guess between the three of us, we all saw the game tonight, and I was at my son's musical performance, so I came in just as Jeff Niemann was mercifully getting pulled, and that's when Brad tuned out. Brad, why don't you start and tell us with your observations about the game tonight?
Well, you know, it was really frustrating watching Niemann because there were times where it felt like he was doing well, like he was getting pitches in the zone, he was throwing strikes, but at the same time, he was getting tagged really hard, and he was hitting guys, and you could see that he was up in the zone. He was up and to the right also. So it seemed like, I don't know, it really feels like at this point he might just be discombobulated. He's had one good start this year so far, and it was a pretty good start, I mean, in all honesty. But it really feels like he's got something wrong with his delivery, or something's not clicking right for him, because he's not getting down in the zone. And though he was doing well at times, in general, he never really got low in the zone, and he never got that downward angle on those pitches that a big guy like him relies on.
You know, I hate to play devil's advocate about the one good start, but his one good start was against the Twins. If there's an offense that is struggling more than our Rays were struggling over the early part of the season, it's the Twins, you know, Maurer being out, Morneau and Young having the flu and whatnot. So this is it's a struggling lineup. They just hit their sixth and seventh team home runs tonight against Baltimore. So yeah, that's the devil's advocate of me. I'm really not trying to single out Niemann about how bad he's been since the second half. I tweeted this earlier tonight. You know, 5-9 with an ERA of 7.53, a FIP of 5.06. That's where he's been of late. So that's been, you know, a bit problematic with where he's been. And, you know, Steve and I were talking offline. I see that his signal just dropped briefly here. But we were talking offline. You know, Niemann had 10 swings and misses tonight. Despite his struggles, I'm looking at his pitch plot, and half his pitches are way up in his zone. But yet he still had 10 swings and misses tonight. So it's really puzzling why, you know, if a guy's that bad, there's no way he's getting 10 swings and misses unless these guys were just trying to swing out of their heels at fat pitches and were just coming up empty.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a mixed bag tonight. He was doing well. I mean, he was getting those swings, and so it didn't really ever feel like he was just getting blown up. But and granted, some of those hits on him were bunt singles from Juan Pierre early in the game, and there was actually one where he bunted it down to Felipe Lopez, and it was almost an out, but it ended up bouncing, giving a funny hop, and Koshman couldn't scoop it, and so Juan Pierre ended up on third with none out, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's be real. He probably would have been there anyways on stolen bases the way Niemann and Jaso have been going. But, I mean, I did see that Jaso did throw his first base runner of the season tonight when he got Carlos Quint in the first inning. So I guess there's a good sign there.
Yeah, I mean, and that was actually – it was a pretty good throw. And he had another one there he was really close on where it was just on the other side of – it was on the third base side of second base. And so Zobrist had to pull it over, and he almost got another caught stealing on the night. But overall, he didn't have a terrible night behind the plate, I felt like, at least as much as I saw.
Steve, what about you?
Yeah, no, sorry, my call cut out there for a bit, so I missed some of that. But, yeah, I have to say, I thought Jaso did pretty good back there tonight. To be honest, most of it, when Neiman's on the mound, I think falls on him. He's very slow to the plate at the moment. They did a couple of stolen bases off him, and the one that I saw, I caught kind of the tail end of his starts in the last couple of innings and then the latter half of the game. And that one just seemed totally on him. Jaso made a pretty good throw, but it was just at that point. And I think it was
the Omar Vizcaya.
Yeah, he had that was him his steal. It was totally off of Niemann at that point.
And yeah, that was ridiculous. Vizcaya was halfway across to second base before Niemann even let go of the ball.
Oof.
It was really bad.
Well, I mean, it's the way I look at it, I think there was two of three tonight, three or four, which puts it at, or I think it was two of three. So that makes 29 of the last 33 guys that have tried to steal second base off him have done so, which is, you know, a pretty high ratio. I know that the other time they tried to pair him up with Šopek, and Šopek was actually able to throw out some guys. So yeah, that helps. But now we're looking at a Jeff Niemann that's 0-3 with a 7.08 ERA so far in the season. And obviously, you know, he's out of options. They can't send him down there. And, you know, we talked about the one good start that he's had, where even then it'll be, you know, more hits and innings pitched kind of thing, low strikeout total. You know, where do we go from here with him?
You know, that's the thing, is he's got a really high ERA, and even his fielding independent pitching, I mean, it's better than his ERA right now. His FIP is better than his ERA, but the fact is that he's not fielding independent right now. He's basically giving up free doubles because he can't stop base runners. He's giving up free steals to basically anybody who gets on base, so a single is turning into a double constantly. And so I really feel like that the Rays have got to concoct some sort of injury with him, say dead arm, say whatever they've got to do, and send him down, bring up Torres, bring up Hayhurst, bring up anybody who can pitch in his place. And I mean, honestly, replacement level might be an improvement at this point.
Yeah, I got to agree with that. I think a lot of it right now with Niemann comes down, something's off with his mechanics. I mean, I don't know enough to really be able to say exactly what, but, you know, Madden was saying it after his past couple starts that he wasn't liking what he saw from Niemann. And before the game today, there are a couple quotes in some of the game notes about how he was looking for some specific things for Niemann, and Niemann was hoping to get himself lower and to work lower in the zone in particular. He says his, just because he's so tall, he's hoping to throw down more. And it definitely, I mean, that wasn't going on tonight. So need someone new in there. And I think the only way really at this point is some sort of DL stint. It's just a matter of how soon the Rays get around to that or figure it out.
I mean, one of the good things, you know, Alex Torres had a good start tonight. I mean, 5 innings, 4 walks. He walked, you know, all 4 of those guys in the first 2 innings, but he also struck out 10 tonight. And he is on that same, you know, he and Niemann are on that same kind of rotation. If something were to happen, you know, like we said earlier, there's no options. You can't set him down there. I don't know if setting him down to the bullpen, you know, letting he and Sonnenstein switch spots. Sonnenstein, you know, hadn't pitched since April 10th. As the long relief guy. So this, you know, is Niemann going to work it out and decide one of these things where I don't know if that's going to happen. So if, you know, if something were to happen, he's had the back troubles in the past. If they could find something there and Niemann didn't fight it. But, you know, Madden said those comments last start out when he yanked him against the White Sox. And Niemann said, no, it wasn't what I saw. You know, I saw this. And so there was some kind of disagreement there. So you'd have to wonder how cooperative he would be if something were to, you know, come up with a back, something with his back or something that is being noticed. Maybe with some of the pitch FX data with the release points, because we know that, you know, Josh Calk works with the team. That's one of the things that made him famous before the club hired him, was looking at that kind of data. So, you know, it's something to watch.
I mean, there's one other thing to consider, and I'm not sure what the statistics will be like after tonight's start, but his XFIP, his expected fielding independent pitching, is pretty much where it was last year. And he's got a high BABIP and a high batting average on balls in play and a low left on base percentage. So there are indications that he has been a bit unlucky. But at the same time, we look at the process, and the process isn't what it usually is, what it's supposed to be for him. He's not getting balls low in the zone like we expect from him. He's not getting grounded. He's getting swinging strikes, but they seem to be on high pitches, and he's also getting hit really hard high in the zone too. So I feel like, you know, it may not be a bad idea to give him some time in the bullpen, maybe let him try to work stuff out in garbage time or something, and let on Andy Sonnenstein come in, because Sonnenstein is one of those pitchers who I believe fares better in a rotation rather than in the bullpen, because he doesn't really gain that much velocity, and he's more of a finesse pitcher anyway.
Yeah, when I look at his data here, again, this is since the All-Star break of last year, his left on base percentage is 56%. So, yeah, that speaks to these guys getting a second base on steals and whatnot. His BABIP's 332, which is not terrible, but that 56% is just outrageous.
Yeah, even if he's being slightly unlucky, I think something's still got to change at this rate. It can't really kind of keep going along as it is. It's weird, though. I mean, tonight's start, he had some good signs. He got about 10 whiffs on around 89 pitches, which I thought was rather high considering how all over the place he seemed otherwise. There are some good signs. It's overall, it's not a great picture still.
Right, I mean, his average velocity is 94, so he was up there. He had max speed of 94 tonight. Average fastball was 91. That's typical Niemann. And that same stretch I mentioned earlier, since the All-Star break last year, his K9 is 7.2. So, you know, that number's there. Just everything else seems to be going to pot.
That's why I feel like it might just be time for a 15-day DL trip, give him some time to try to sort things out and then bring it back into the rotation so that we can sort of, you know, see what we've got here. Because ultimately, if there is some sort of long-term problem with him, if he's got something in his delivery that's totally messed up, then we need to know sooner rather than later, I feel like.
I feel right now just a break will be good for him just mentally. If looking at him on the mound tonight that I saw towards the end of the game, you can tell that he kind of just seemed he looked a little flustered and kind of down. And after the when he got pulled at the end of the game, he just had this kind of bewildered look on his face. He didn't know what was going on. And at this point, I mean, like he knows, you know, there's something mechanical going on, and he's just his confidence in terms of and getting it right, I'm sure, is at a pretty low spot. So if he just has a bit of a chance to work on it, to smooth things out in low-pressure situations and have some time to work on it, hopefully that'll help.
Right. I mean, now the switch over to the offense, look at the final box score tonight. 8 hits, 11 strikeouts, 3 walks. So they were on base as often as they struck out tonight. This was in 32 at-bats. You know, the much-maligned cleanup hitter Felipe Lopez took a hat trick tonight. You know, Matt Joyce 1-for-4, so BJ Upton another 0-for. He's, you know, 4-for his last 37, really on a dry run. You know, RJ, often we IM during the game, he made an interesting observation as the club's heading to Toronto. The Rays and the Jays are equal in home run totals as these guys start facing off tomorrow, yet it's the Jays that have more walks as a team than the Rays, and this is the team that we all poked fun at last year for their grip it and rip it and never walking and getting on base. Yet it's the yet it's the Rays that are coming up to Toronto with less walks than the Jays.
I think that might actually come down to part of the approach that both of these teams had last year, because the Jays were a team last year that would just swing at literally everything. Teams are just throwing them garbage, and they've reacted to that perhaps, and they've just sort of laid off a bit more. And at the same time, the Rays were a team that just wouldn't swing at anything last year, and now they're getting everything in the zone, and they're forced to swing at it a bit more often.
Yeah, and our lineup right now, I mean, it's not what we were looking at to start the year either. We don't have as many quality hitters in there, as many patient people in there as well. And Felipe Lopez is good, but it's not also the most patient hitter. I just have it up right now. The Rays have a 7% walk rate, which is around the sixth worst in the majors at the moment, which is, I mean, quite a lot off of where they were last year. They were towards the top of the league with something like an 11%, I believe. So it's, quite a drastic turnaround. I mean, I feel like there's still a lot of the same hitters in there. There's still, we know Matt Joyce, we know BJ Upton, we know all these guys can take a walk and everything. It's some of that, I think, is early season, just small sample size, and it'll stabilize going forward. But it's still not a great trend. We're not getting those base runners that we need. With the couple with the low batting average that we've had, it's not a great combination.
Yeah, I agree. You know, part of the problem, we saw it, I complained about it over the weekend, you know, for people that were at for those who are at the live event listening in, you know, how the Rays have hit with runners in scoring position in this White Sox series and even in that Twin series. There were a lot of times runner on second with no outs and they're hitting fly balls to left field, you know, first and second with no outs and they're hitting ground balls to the left side of the field. So I feel that there's some room for improvement on situational hitting. It seems kind of petty to complain about a team going 6-2 on a homestand as they just did and whatnot. But I felt there's a lot of wasted opportunities for the offense where, you know, when you're batting a Felipe Lopez in cleanup and you've got to mix and match the 5 through 9 spots of your lineup, that you have to take advantage of some of these opportunities. Even tonight, you saw you get bases loaded with one out, and Jaso hits to a 1-2-3 double play to end what could have been a nice way to start off the game.
Well, to be honest, I almost feel like we've been lucky to get the runs we've had so far. I mean, what with the lineup we're running out there right now with Lopez in cleanup and Cashman in there every day and just trying to make things meet until Longo gets back. It's I mean, not the most impressive lineup you'll find around there, basically. And we haven't scored a lot of runs this past week, but we've had some really great pitching performances from Price and Shields. And that's really been the difference here. If we didn't have the pitching as superb as it was, you know, we wouldn't have had this sort of a homestand.
And, you know, one of the things you were talking about there, the luck with the hits, it really has turned around a lot this last week. We've actually been incredibly unlucky incredibly lucky. The early season start, we had a sub-200 BABIP for the team. And now the BABIP has climbed all the way up to about 270, which is closer to league average around where a lot of the teams are right now. And so, I mean, this last homestand, we actually had a pretty strong amount of luck when it came to getting balls in play and then landing for hits and stuff. So that's not going to sustain itself more than likely. So the Rays are going to have to find a way to produce with walks and produce with homers and other ways other than just getting lucky.
Other than Sam Fold, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, you've seen him, he had another good night tonight. As long as he's staying on top of the ball and hitting line drives, there was a stretch there in games two or three where he was, like, getting under the ball and hitting these fly balls. And same thing with, like, Juan Pierre. I know Matt Joyce keeps stealing fly balls from him, and same thing with Sam Fold, but, you know, that's Juan Pierre's fault. Juan Pierre should never hit fly balls to the fence. Exactly. That's just not what he, you know, same thing with Sam Fold. Stay on top of the ball, hit line drives, hit singles and doubles, you know, steal the extra base, that kind of thing. But this series going into Toronto worries me some. You know, the Rays have not been good against left-handed pitching. We saw Brian Dunsing. You know, I think Brian Dunsing's a very average major league starter. He's very good against left-handers. You know, right-handers, not so much. But, you know, the Rays are going into the series, and they get Jojo Reyes on Friday night, and they get Ricky Romero on Sunday. Romero's coming off a bad start, and so is Reyes, frankly. But they're both left-handed, and Romero in particular has given the Rays troubles in the past. And then right in the middle is our good buddy Brandon Morrow. And the last time the Rays saw this guy, 17 strikeouts. So this could be one of those series that could go either way. It could be, you know, problems on Fridays and Sundays with the lefty, and then Morrow is just an awful matchup for this team still this year.
And frankly, those are like questions that it's really hard to actually find an answer for, because the roster, just as it is, without Evan Longoria, doesn't have a really dominant hitter in it. I mean, Matt Joyce has been doing well against right-handers, but two of those guys are good left-handers. So what do you do against that? I don't know. It's going to be a very interesting series. And if we can come out with two wins, that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's also kind of worries me. I mean, Matt Joyce right now is definitely the best hitter in our lineup. He's been on fire recently, and his average is up over 300, and he's hitting for power, and still waiting for that first home run. But he's been looking great, and if he's out of the lineup and not hitting, I mean, like we said, Upton's in the slump, and Zobrist hasn't been great. He's been all right. I mean, he's been showing some more signs, I guess. I'm still hoping that – I mean, he has three home runs, leads the team and everything like that, so I'm hoping he's – going to come around, but not great. I mean, Damon's back in the lineup, which helps, but again, he's a lefty, and yeah, it could be
rough. Really does feel like the arrow is pointing upward with a lot of the guys in the lineup. You mentioned Zobrist and Damon, both those guys, they have three home runs right now, and that's frankly more than we expected from, I think, either of them at this point in the year. And in general, I think that they will hit well this year, but even when they're hitting at their best, this still isn't a very threatening lineup.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that goes with in the Rays' favor in this series, though, is, you know, you figure the three best pitchers are going. You've got, you know, you'll have Hellickson tomorrow night. You'll have Price on Saturday. You'll have Shields on Sunday. You know, Shields did have that horrendous start there last year where he got up six home runs in the one start, but he did come back the outing afterwards, gave up two more home runs. You know, he gave up eight and 14 innings up there last year, but he did get a win last time he was up there. So it's not like he's coming back right after that horrendous six home run adventure. This is obviously not the same kind of Blue Jays lineup as it was last year. They don't have, you know, they mixed and matched some names. Vernon Wells is gone. Aaron Hill is injured. He's off to a slow start. Edwin Encarnacion, even though I picked him to hit 30 home runs, has still not hit his first home run. So, you know, I'm not looking very brilliant there.
Does not bode well for us.
Yeah. There's a lot of things there. I know JP Aaron CBA hit one to, like, Windsor the other day. So it's a different kind of lineup. They've got Corey Patterson hitting second in this lineup right now, which is a favor for the most part, as Rajah Davis is out. They got Jason Nix playing. So, you know, this is it should be, if the pitchers can do their job and keep it down. Yeah, this has been a place where we've gone and given up a lot of home runs, and that's been problematic, but you don't have to worry about the Blue Jays have been very aggressive on the base pass. That's one of the reasons why I'm glad Jeff Niemann pitched tonight and not up there, because, yeah, you know, Travis Snyder and Aaron Hill are both one steal away from setting career highs for a season, and we're not even out of April yet. So these guys are running like crazy up there, and it's a good thing that our guys that typically, you know, Niemann's out of the way, you don't have to worry about that. So that should help neutralize one of the advantages I felt Toronto had coming into the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be interesting. Oh, go for it, Brad.
No, you take it.
Okay, I was just going to say, it'll be interesting to see along the lines of the base stealing how this breaks down in terms of Shopik and Jaso getting starts, basically. I mean, Shopik's kind of been catching for Shields this season so far, and I mean, he's definitely at this point the better defensive catcher. Can't really deny that. He's Even he hasn't even been great throwing out runners, but he's been better than GSO has. So I'll be interested to see if Madden ends up using him more this weekend and to try and keep the runners off, to keep the runners from going as much.
Yeah, I could see something where Shopik gets the Friday and Sunday game, and then JSO takes a Saturday game, especially, you know, that he caught tonight. So do a little bit of alternate. It works out well with the lefty-righty-lefty pitching rotation that the Jays are going to have. But I really like, you know, I wrote about this last year about how well JSO and Shopik and Shields tend to work together. If you look at the body of work, it's pretty much night and day, the results with when Shields is pitching to Shopik as compared to JSO. And if you look, I know it's catcher ERA needs some more sample size, but there's a trend there. I'm almost wondering if we're going to have a caddy situation, because Shields definitely has his best games when Shopik's behind the dish.
And, you know, at this point, it's not like JSO has really been hitting so well that he's fighting for playing time from Shopik. I mean, Shopik has a home run, JSO has a home run, so it's not like either one of them has really been utterly dominant. So at this point, I would be willing to put one of them in based on what is consistently happening right now, and that is their defense. One of them has been a little bit better than the other, although it's pretty marginal. I mean, frankly, when we're trumping up elements of Kelly Shopik's defense, I think it's a bad sign for catcher defense on the team, because those are not two specialists behind the plate, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we talked to earlier about, you know, Steve mentioned the 7% walk rate. That reflects on JSO. This is a guy who did a great job last year at getting on base with a walk. We're now, you know, 15 games into the season, he's had 36 at-bats, and he has two walks. That's very on-JSO-like, and that's one of the reasons why his on-base percentage is .237 right now. Yeah, thank goodness he hit that home run the other day. You know, we're talking, he has seven hits, two doubles, and the home run that he hit the other night, but he's just not getting on base. That's why he's down there at the bottom of the lineup. Hitting eight, and if you've got a lineup, let's look at Saturday, you're probably going to have JSO hitting eight and Brignac hitting nine, two guys that are really struggling. Brignac's yet to have an extra base hit. He's chasing a lot of pitches, and that feeds right into Morrow's thing. The bottom of the lineup could be a dead zone on Saturday.
Yeah, and then, you know, extra base hits has been something that this team has not really mustered a whole lot of, it seems like, in general. I mean, tonight, by the time people listen to this, it'll be yesterday's loss to the White Sox. They had eight hits, all singles. I mean, we actually still, despite that, had a couple of bases loaded situations where we could have scored some runs. But, I mean, you want extra base hits, and they're just not coming right now, and hopefully that'll turn around.
You want to hear something scary? I'm looking at this right now. The Rays have more total bases as a team than the Red Sox do right now. You would think, I guess it all comes from that one game, but it's 223 to 215 with total bases, and Rays have an extra game on it. But still, I never would have thought it was that close.
That one game definitely skews it like crazy. I mean, that 16 runs in one game and everything, it's without that, our offense is looking a lot worse. But I want to go back real quick. I was just looking at JSO, your comment about his walk rate and everything made me curious. And he's swinging at less pitches outside the zone this year still. He's at a 14% outside swing rate. Well, it was at 18% last year, which I take it to mean kind of he's still being selective. It's just pitchers, if they're getting behind in the count on him or getting late in the count, they're like, well, why would I walk this guy? Let's throw him something and let him make contact with it and get him out that way. Or challenge him more, and he's not making anyone pay at the moment. He had his one home run the other night, which is a nice sign, but still he hasn't been the offensive force to make him throw him balls.
And that's the kind of thing I feel like over the course of a season that would eventually even out, because he is a professional player. He is going to be able to make adjustments to what pitchers are doing, and eventually he's going to make more solid contact on pitches that in the previous weeks he wasn't making solid contact on. And hopefully that'll normalize back to an area where he is still an offensively capable catcher. But at the same time, he still had a good year last year that it's unlikely he would be able to replicate very easily. So I expect he won't be a terrible hitting catcher, but at the same time, I'm still ready for Robinson Chirinos.
Yeah, Chernos is actually – I was looking at this the other day. You know, this is a guy that started off the season like 1-for-29, but he is he's got his average up close to 200 now. He's had – it was 2-for-2 earlier tonight when I was checking the scores. So his bat's starting to come around, and our hero Jose Lobaton is down to 400 from that 600 average that he had when we were talking this time last week. So we'll see how that reality hits hard. So we'll see how that situation plays out as that comes up in a few weeks. But, you know, that 1-for-29 start was definitely concerning. And obviously Desmond Jennings, everybody keeps looking at him. He's having a very nice run of it so far. More walks and strikeouts. He's had a bunch of extra base hits of late. And we mentioned earlier about Alex Torres. His is a good start. So Durham's having a – they're off to a pretty good start down there.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people, a lot of sort of mainstream analysts or prospect mavens recently kind of constantly like, call up Desmond Jennings. And there, a lot of people have been kind of saying that Jennings will be up soon and in the next month. And I still think it'll be at their time. But it's with the lineup running out there every day, it's, my patience is beginning to wear thin. You know, I know we have to wait for a certain amount of time for him to not be a super two and for us to, you know, have him be cheaper and everything. But it's tough to be patient when you're watching this lineup every day.
Yeah, it is definitely very tough when we're not scoring a lot of runs. I mean, honestly, our outfield has been generally pretty productive. B.J. Upton was really strong at the beginning of the year. He's definitely slowed down now. But as a whole, I mean, Sam Fold, Matt Joyce, and B.J. Upton have been pretty productive, so it's hard to push one of them out. But, yeah, ultimately what matters most to the Rays is long-term sustainability. And if they call up Jennings now, they're getting an extra month of Jennings and trading off an extra year. And that's just, that makes absolutely no sense for this team.
Right. And that's part of the long-term sustainability. That's how you control those costs. Look at, you know, look at the Giants. The Giants just sent Brandon Belt down. They let him come up and start the season, let him play for the first few weeks rather than, you know, if they would have let him stay down for the first 20 days, they buy an extra year. Instead, they let him come up, play the first 20 days, and then send him down. You know,
yeah, and the New York Yankees thank him for that.
Yeah, you know, he'll be in New York an extra year quicker. The Mariners with Michael Pineda, I know Michael Pineda is really good. You watch him pitch, you're like, damn, this kid's really good. But at the same time, he's the difference between the Mariners winning 63 and winning 68 games. It just really does not make any sense for them to do that. You know, right now he's a you know, nice gate draw, a nice story for now. But 4 years from now, they're going to be looking at themselves going, Jesus, what the hell were we thinking with exactly. that? You know, with the Rays, I know it's frustrating to see, you know, Felipe Lopez hitting cleanup and all these kind of things. But there really are no better options. I mean, if you call up Desmond Jennings now, it might work in the short term. But he came up last year and frankly didn't look that good, especially in the field. I mean, he did not look – you know, for a guy with his athleticism, he looked like he was a wide receiver playing right field last year on some of those fly balls. So, you know, no guarantees. And the trade market typically is not very active in baseball this time of year because everybody thinks they're contending. I know if you're playing fantasy baseball, you're trying to make trades. But in real baseball, if you look back in April and May records, there typically are not a lot of trades this time of year.
Yeah, and I mean – that is one of the tough things. It's early in the season. We're excited about the season. When things don't go the way you want them to, you feel like something. You got to do something. You got to make a change. You got to start pushing yourself in the right direction. But I mean, as we saw after that first week, eventually things might just level themselves out and take care of themselves. And we do have a huge addition coming up in the return of Evan Longoria and the return of J.P. Howell. I mean, that changes the bullpen, and the bullpen's actually been pretty strong despite his absence. But it changes the bullpen and it changes the whole batting order and the whole infield so much. I mean, we add so much defense. We add so much power when we get Evan Longoria back. Hopefully he's healthy. But, I mean, that is one thing, is that getting back to 500 without him was a pretty big start in the first place. I think that's going to be one thing that benefits this team down the road. Hopefully Longoria catches fire, carries the team a little bit, and we actually stay in the thick of it.
Yeah, getting back to 500, I mean, I wasn't expecting us to get back this quickly. I mean, last year when the Red Sox had their initial slump when they had a bunch of injuries in the beginning of the year and fell behind early, it was until the middle of May, I believe, until they were back up over 500 consistently. And, I mean, we're under 500 now after losing tonight and everything, but it's so close to this point. I mean, well, we'll see how this Blue Jays series go, I guess. It's just being this close with Evan Longoria coming back, and it's definitely – helped my confidence in this team going forward for the season, and seems to with the fans as well, a lot more fans there tonight, 16,000, I guess, tonight as opposed to a week ago. I think you pointed that out on Twitter, Jason, 10,000 last week.
Yeah, I did. You know, I was there last Thursday night with Tommy, and it was 10,042, and tonight it was 16,371. That's a 68% increase in fans. And I went back and looked at it before tonight. The largest crowd on a Thursday night in April was a Red Sox game at the end of April in 09 when there was 20,000 people. That's the Red Sox. I mean, during the summer, that's a 34,000 crowd. That was a 20,000 on Thursday night. Typically, if you look back at Thursday, April, the Rays are lucky if they draw 12, and they got 16-7 tonight, which I think is, you know, pretty darn good. And just looking back over last week, and that's the fans responding to, you know, how the team has changed and playing the brand of baseball they have since coming back off that 1-8 road trip, the 1-8 to start the season and whatnot. So, you know, people are going to bash, oh, there's only 16-7 there, but, you know, geez, this team is a 500 team, and it's again a humongous jump from just last week with no special promotion or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for Sam Fold. I mean, he's been like his own walking promotion, basically. The amount of excitement that he's generated, I think, with the fan base with his catches and the Legend of Sam Fold thing on Twitter, that was actually really unprecedented. I was pretty surprised how big it was. We had a lot of new readers coming to D-Rays Bay, and a lot of people looking for a sample of stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of weak for the Red Sox Nation to try the whole Legend of Jed Lowry thing, and, you know, as copycats. And speaking of Legend of Jed Lowry, he's actually playing third base tonight because Kevin Youkilis had to leave the game with some injury. So, you know, something to keep an eye on. I wanted to make one point about the lack of power you were talking about. As I look at our, you know, D-Rays Bay's two favorite players right now, Dan Johnson and Casey Konchman, I see 74 at-bats between those two this year. Guess how many extra base hits that duo was combined for?
I'm guessing three.
Bingo! Three. So, yeah, that, you know, you talk about lack of power. First base is such a power position, and we have three extra base hits from the first base duo this season, which is just – it's amazing. I mean, frankly, amazing. This team's only one game below 500 when you lose your three-hitter, your four-hitter, and your first baseman have combined for three extra base hits and five RBI on the season.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's been definitely a trial and tribulation with first base right now. I actually wrote on Thursday about – Casey Kochman, and, you know, naturally we had a flood of joyful readers who were excited about discussing it in a friendly manner. And one of the things that was really surprising to me was how my feelings about the whole article actually changed during the game. Even I've seen three occasions now where Casey Kochman has failed to dig a throw out of the ground that I felt like weren't terribly difficult. Like today there was the Felipe Lopez throw where it took a high bounce, but still, I mean, it wasn't, I don't know, it didn't feel like the throw was that hot. He could have still gotten it, and if he had caught it or at least knocked it down, it would have prevented Pierre from getting the third base. Wouldn't have changed the outcome of the game, but still, it was surprising to me. And I mean, this is one of those things where every time that happens, the error is always gone to the thrower. And so the second baseman, the third baseman, the shortstop are the ones who almost always get penalized for a first baseman not getting a dig. And frankly, Dan Johnson this year has a little bit outplayed Casey Kochman, in my opinion. Casey Kochman's had some nice stretches and stuff like that. But in general, I really feel like Dan Johnson's defense has been really surprising to me so far. He had the diving into the dugout. He's had some slick digs out of the ground and stuff like that. And I remember actually one of Casey Kochman's first games, he got hit in the chest by a ball that bounced and ended up going in for an infield – or actually ended up going for a reach base on error, an error on the second baseman naturally. So, I mean, I'm surprised that – because one of the things that I trump Kochman for is having above-average defense. He's been about a run above – or a game above average – a win above average defensively at first base, which is pretty impressive because it's not a position where you can be very defensive. I mean, you've got opportunities to do well here and there, but it's not like center field where there's a lot of dynamic and difficult plays coming your way. Usually you're digging balls out of the ground and you're diving for sharply hit ground balls. So, I mean, that's a pretty impressive thing for a first baseman to be able to be that above average. But my eyes are not reporting what ultimate zone rating has been telling me. So, I don't know. What do you guys think on that?
I'm kind of similar, actually. I've got to say, I think Kochman and Danjo have been closer on defense than I was expecting going into it. I don't know. It's tough to really say what to expect from Dan Johnson because we have such a small sample in terms of major league innings to judge him by, like UZR, anything like that. So it's really, you really have to go by your eyes. And I think he's surprised me. I mean, he's made some bad miscues too, and he's had his own share of errors and stuff. But on the whole, he's, like you said, Brad, he's made some really good plays, and I've seen Kashman make some plays I thought he should have made or some scoops he should have made. In the end, I'm kind of thinking that we got spoiled with Carlos Pena here. The more I watch him with Gulem, I'm realizing more and more how amazing Pena was on defense. I mean, he was the king of scoops, basically. I mean, anything that was around, he said, just throw it on the ground and I'll catch it, and it was pretty true. I don't know how he's doing in Chicago right now. Actually, this year, I know his offense has been pretty rough, but his defense
still has been amazing. But one of the things I'm wondering, do you guys know this? Ultimate Zone Rating (UZR) does it actually account for scoops and stuff like that? Because I feel like that's something that I don't know how they could cover that.
I know one of the advanced stats doesn't use scoops. Is it UZR or DRS? No, I think it's defensive run saved, the plus minus that has a scoops one for.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say as well.
Yeah. It's normally a pretty small rate. That would be an interesting thing to take a look at, actually, to see what the different rates are.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with part of my issue with Dan Johnson last year. There were some times when he was in there when he had to play first and whatnot, where he looked, quite stiff, especially on plays down the line, plays that Pena was normally very good at. You could see a noticeable drop off when Dan Johnson was in there. This year, I feel he's done very well on plays like that, plays down the line. I don't think he's moved well to his. To his right, but I think he's done better over there. And again, with the scoops and whatnot, it hasn't been as bad as people expected. Obviously there's gonna be a drop off going from Pena, but again, overall, I don't think that's been a big problem. As we get back and look at the offense again, we talk about the three extra base hits. That's as many as John Jaso has by himself. If you look at the total bases, these guys have 19 total bases between them. Sean Rodriguez has 18 by himself and less playing time. So that's where that's where it really hurts. But in first base, if we look back at the free agent market, there wasn't any solution. I mean, the first base is expensive. You look at there was an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day about how Rays haven't used a pitcher over the age of 30 since Mark Hendrickson threw a game, or Jaso, one of those guys. But 30-year-old pitchers on free agencies tend to be expensive if they're any good. Well, same thing with first base. Mm-hmm. First base is a power position. Power costs money in arbitration. People want to say, I was one of them, I wanted Russell Branyan here, but I firmly believe the Rays had a deadline and Russell Branyan was holding out for greener grass in the form of a major league deal that never came. And that's why he eventually signed with Arizona. But there was no affordable first base solution out in the market. And right now, again, if there's a trade, if you want to go talk to Arizona, since they're filled with Brandon Allen and Russell Branyan, Juan Miranda, they've got three left-handed big power bats, and one of them's in AAA and the other two are fighting for playing time with Xavier Nady. So, but trades aren't made this time of year, so this wasn't a matter of poor planning on the Rays' part. This was what the market did, and I'd rather see them put a Dan Johnson in there and hope that he does better than go out and spend $7.5 million on Derek Lee, who's not off to a great start with Baltimore either.
Yeah, and like we've always assumed, this year is going to be, to a degree, a rebuilding year. The reloading year and everything. And so I'm perfectly fine keeping Danjo and letting him try and work things out at first base. If it really bombs and he doesn't work out, then it happens. And at least he was a shot at having a nice cheap first baseman that could produce. And based on the stats we had looking at us, he's definitely been worth at least a try for most of the season. Kochman, he's, crazily enough, he is producing them up at the moment. He's hitting all singles, but he's at least getting something on offense. He's plugging in the hole at the meantime. And so it really kind of depends on what the expectations, I guess, are for the Rays this season. If you really want us to make a push to the playoffs, then you would want us to get a first baseman, a real trade for a real slugger right now. But I'm kind of fine just taking things as they go. We've got to still have a talented enough team to be competitive and to make a push. But I don't think we're at that point where we're kind of serious enough about the playoffs and going deep into the year that we need to freak out about getting a power first baseman or anything like that.
And even then, when you acquire a first baseman, you have to be thinking, what are we going to give up? And the Rays have one real significant advantage in their minor leagues, and that is their pitching. But at the same time, we might be in the need of some of that pitching sooner than we expect if Jeff Niemann can put things together. So there's a lot of give and take there. I mean, do you want to add some first base power for a year or something? Like somebody mentioned Billy Butler today. I would love Billy Butler, but I think we'd only have him for one, maybe 2 years, because he's been up in the majors for so long. He wouldn't be very cost effective. And so we'd be giving up maybe 4 or 5 years of, I don't know, Torres or someone else at the gain of getting Butler for 1 or 2 years. It may not be worth it in the long run.
Well, actually, Butler had that new deal he has grabbed. So that would help out a little bit. Butler's getting signed. You can control him at $8 million for next year, $8 million in 2013, $8 million in 2014, with a club option of 12.5 and 15. So, again, he'd have to produce and continue an upward trend and get out of this, 18 to 20 home run, 300 hitter, which is, a nice stat line. But if you look at first base, it kind of blends in well enough. Billy Butler, would love to have him here. He'd be a huge solution. But I mentioned this in that same thread. What do you give the Royals? I mean, the Royals farm system is more loaded than the Rays farm system. So, that kind of matchup's just not going to happen. So you've got to get major league talent up. And you can say, just give them Jeff Niemann. Well, they've seen Jeff Niemann pitch too. And they need to make room for these prospects coming up, not take guys that they're going to have to. This is why the Royals got into trouble. They would take these guys entering these arbitration years or take these free agent cast offs and overpay them at the cost of their other prospects getting a chance. And then, right now, Luke Hochevar was their opening day starter. But that's not a bad thing, because they realize, I don't have to go out and sign overpaid stiff just because they're out there. Let's just go ahead and pitch with what we've got. These guys are all on 1 year deals. We can let them go if we want. And then we've got all these guys coming up. So again, Billy Butler would be awesome. But when you try to look at a matchup that's going to be major league talent, a guy like Sean Rodriguez seems to fit real well. But then again, you're looking at offense, you're going to give up a guy that people really think has a good offensive future to bring in a first baseman who's a lot more expensive, which adds, becomes a payroll issue.
Yeah, I love trading for players, but I hate having to give up people to get them. That's kind of the thing, especially with our loaded prospects. It's I don't know. You get attached to them to a degree. You have all these arms in there, and there's the whole idea that there's no such thing as a pitching prospect. That pitching prospects can fade out and fizzle, and you never know how things are going to work out. And so I've always been very hesitant to trade for a first baseman, trade one of our pitchers for a first baseman or a hitter, unless we're really sure that hitter is going to be an impact hitter that we're going to have for a long period of time. And if we're going to trade for someone that would be around for a number of years that we feel had power potential and would fit in well, then I'd be all for it. It would just be a matter of finding the right price and seeing if it would work. I don't think many teams are going to be willing to give up a player like that. But at the same time, the Rays may be stuck into kind of looking for one of those younger players to try and make a deal, and may have to give up a bit more because they don't have many impact bats in the minors at the moment, especially at first base or the corners. Its power is at a premium, and it's not really something where you have much depth at in the minors. I mean, we have Chirinos or anything, but he's much more valuable a catcher.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's be honest, though, the next in-season trade that Andrew Friedman makes to acquire major league talent will be his first one. If you think about, when you traded Aubrey Huff away, let's take it back. Dan Wheeler, when you made a trade, when you traded Ty Wigginton to get Dan Wheeler, that's pretty much the only time the club has dealt away something to get a player of major league talent. In season, everything else has happened out of season. When the club was in contention in 2008, they did nothing. Last year, when the club was in contention at trade deadline, they did nothing. So when you look at that kind of track record, it's kind of silly to expect them to do something now when most people don't even think they're in contention at all.
Well, I mean, at one point, I believe we did trade for Jason Bay, and then we didn't, or something. I don't know.
Chastain. Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Go ahead, sorry.
I think we are kind of glossing over one thing that's really important here. Jason, do you have Billy Butler's contract memorized?
No. I have COTS. Jeff Houston runs the COTS contract site. He happens to be one of my colleagues at Baseball Prospectus. So I happen to have his stuff right there at the top, because I swear I reference that site at least once a day.
Okay, well, that's very impressive. By the way, one of the things we do have sort of an ace in the hole, if nothing else, is Brandon Guyer, who's 25 years old down in AAA. He's been doing well this year. He's been doing well in the past. There is a chance that maybe we want to shift Johnny Damon to first base and give Brandon Guyer a chance in at DH. I mean, that puts us with five outfielders on the roster. That's not really what you expect going into the season. But, I mean, he's a guy who's getting closer to that age where you do want to bring him up and start, you know, using him through his physical peak. Mm-hmm. And so he's also a guy who's been successful in the minor leagues. So maybe he ends up coming up instead of Desmond Jennings near the All-Star break if Jennings isn't really, you know, doing great around that time.
I mean, I also have no problem with, you know, with trying to throw a first baseman glove on Kelly Schoppick every now and then against tough lefties and let him do some first base action and call up Chirinos to give him some more time behind the plate. Yeah. I think there's some flexibility here. I have no problem putting a first baseman glove on Damon or Schoppick, letting him try if this Kochman Johnson situation doesn't get any better. You know, the club keeps talking about finding another way of doing things. There's another way of doing things. You know, move those, put them over there against tough lefties. It's really tough to watch Dan Johnson and Casey Kochman try to hit those left-handed pitching. If you can let Schoppick, he's done it a couple of times in his career, to let him go over and try that and see what happens.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I've long been a defender of Dan Johnson, probably too much. So, but in the minors and even in Japan, I believe he never really had much of a platoon split. He was a pretty neutral hitter, which is surprising given that he is such a pull hitter. But I really feel like that in the long run, if the Rays do give him enough time, he could hit 20 homers and hit them off of both hands. But just right now, it seems like he's not being able to see the ball well or something, because it's just not going well for him. Ultimately, though, I mean, he isn't a long-term solution. He's already 30, 31, I think, mm-hmm. maybe even mm-hmm. 32. And so, I mean, they do need to be thinking about maybe they want to bring up Guyer or Chirinos or do something else to get these other guys acclimated and ready for next year.
Well, the other thing before we wrap up, I wanted to, you know, the news came out today that baseball is thinking about going to 10 teams for the playoffs in 2012. Before I share my thoughts on that, what do you guys feel about that news?
I'm torn on it personally. I think, on one hand, it would help with competitive balance to a degree. It would help the Rays for sure just competing in the AL East, it's so tough to get that one wild card spot. It would give us a little bit more flexibility in terms of making the playoffs. At the same time, I guess kind of the devil is in the details and how it would actually work out in the end. So I guess they're talking about making the two wild card teams essentially do a play-in game or a short series, which wouldn't really be ideal, and it would I don't know. We kind of have to see how that all works. And on the other hand, I feel like it's really a big money ploy for Major League Baseball. If you want to look competitive balance, the way to do it would just be to get rid of the divisions, have one American League, the National League, have the top four, however many teams from each league make the playoffs, which would basically solve the exact same sort of issue they're trying to do with this. But the only difference is, with this, they get an extra playoff team, they get more money, they get more games, and that's really what they're going for here, I think. So I kind of like it. I think it'll potentially help the Rays, but I'm not really sure how it'll work out in the end.
You know, I'm torn too, but for slightly different reasons. I like the idea of basically three playoff teams in the AL East. That's ultimately what this comes down to. It's basically Bud Selig saying, okay, Red Sox and Yankees, you're guaranteed to come in, and those troublemakers in Tampa won't bother you. But so, I mean, that's cool. The Rays basically have a much better shot at making the playoffs every year, and that makes me really excited. But at the same time, it is already the most difficult era of winning a World Series since baseball began, because it used to be that you would take the best winning percentages, you'd have them square off, and that would be how you decided your champion. But now you basically have a crapshoot that's got so many different variables in it, so many different teams in it. By adding an extra layer, adding extra wild card teams, that's just going to mean that you may end up with even more teams that are terrible winning the World Series. Like we've had teams like the Detroit Tigers from, I think, 2007 or 2006, 2005 maybe, in the mid-2000s, they were absolutely terrible. They made it to the World Series. The St. Louis Cardinals in the early 2000s, I believe, were actually fairly terrible, and they made it to the World Series. So, I mean, you have teams that didn't do well during the regular season who end up with this unrealistic and unfair shot at the playoff or at the championship. And so, I mean, that's a bummer. But at the same time, what do I care? It's already a crapshoot, you know. Might as well let the Rays get into the playoffs.
Yeah, my thought on it was I'm a big fan of the play-in game. I think that there's no, you know, we saw it last year. There's no advantage to winning your division. The Rays won the division. The Yankees, you know, quote unquote, lost when they lost the lead to the Rays. They ended up getting to face the Twins, a team that they matched up terrifically against. You know, they own them every year in the playoffs. So there was, you know, a lot of people were saying, oh, the Yankees didn't mind losing. They didn't want to win the East because now they get to play the Twins. And sure enough, it worked out just like everybody predicted they would. So I don't think there's enough of a disadvantage for, you know, not winning your division. For me, what I would like to see is a one-game playoff between the fourth and the two wild cards. You play a one game on the Monday after that season, and, you know, odds are they might have to use their best pitcher for that. So it takes away their staff ace. So then they start the next series on the road with their staff ace already burned, and there's a chance their staff ace never gets to pitch. Does it put the wild card at a disadvantage? Sure it does, but I feel that you need to be more rewarded for winning your division than just having a home game. And even with, you know, one of these division winners has to start on the road anyhow. But I think, you know, so one of these division winners is being treated like a wild card team the way it is now, and I don't like that. And these one game playoffs, you know, the Twins had a couple in a row where they had to play, you know, the Tigers one day and then they had to play the White Sox the next day, kind of thing. But I found those one game playoffs extremely exciting because, you know, you win, you're in. You don't, you're gone. And I think that would be a nice way to generate more playoff, you know, get two more teams in the playoffs. But like you said, I think this is a clear money grab by baseball. And to have these guys sit out, if they're talking about a three or a five game series between these extra teams, that means somebody's going to be sitting out. It may work well in football, but you know, these guys get the, you know, an all-star break. Some of these guys get a 3-day break. You know, they get Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off, and they're back on the diamond Thursday. If you're talking about giving these guys who are used to having one day off, you know, every 3 weeks to getting 5 or 6 days off before their next game, that's going to screw with the quality of the game on the field. And that's what I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. Well, we've gone on long enough, and here comes an hour already. Wow. But, you know, again, want to thank you guys for coming on tonight, and we will get this up on the site, you know, as you hear it. Sometime today it will be up on the site, and we'll get the iTunes thing working. We'll keep you posted there. But, again, thanks for coming on, guys, and we'll do this again next week.
All right. Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Jason.
Friends don't dance, and if they don't dance